This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan. Growing up, many of us read about the Holocaust and the Nazis, and we thought, how did people of that generation ever let this happen? How did the world stand and watch? Well, we're living through a massive genocide right now. Since last October, the state of Israel has killed more than 30,000 people, half of whom are children. This is on top of the illegal occupation, settler colonialism, dispossession, ethnic cleansing the Palestinians have faced at the hands of the state of Israel for the past 70 years. We're watching massacres happen live on our mobile phone screens. Yet the most influential media companies in the world, from the West, still take the pro-Israel stance. There are millions of people protesting all over the world, including in the US and the UK. Hundreds of thousands of people march against their governments in DC and London. Yet the political class of the Western Empire do not seem to budge from their pro-Israel stance. Many people around the world are feeling hopeless because of this. There's a sense of doomerism, understandably so. It feels like no matter what we do, we can't defeat the bad guys. So how do we make sense of all of this? That's exactly what I'm going to be talking about on today's episode of What's Politics with my usual guest, Peter Beattie, who's a political economist and political psychologist at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. As always, this conversation is also available as a podcast. Do look up Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Peter, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thank you, Darshan. I'm doing pretty well. How about you?
I'm doing good as well. Excited is perhaps the wrong word. I'm always excited to talk to you, but I think it's been pretty, I don't know, just depressing times, or it can appear that way when it comes to global politics. But today I want to do something a little bit more hopeful, or hopefully we can arrive at some sort of hopeful message throughout the conversation. Let's look at what's happening in Palestine, Peter. Why does the most influential media channels in the world, your Fox, your MSNBCs, your CNNs, your BBCs, New York Times, etc., why do they still play the both sides game, blaming Palestinians, pretend that this so-called conflict began on October the 7th, 2023?
So one thing is source bias. So where do you go to for your sources of information about whatever news item it is of the day? For commercial reasons, it's cheaper to just go to a government press briefing. You don't have to send, you know, reporters halfway across the world to get information. You just show up at a air-conditioned office and listen to the official government spokesperson. That also fits in with the conception of journalistic professionalism, whereby official sources are considered to be highly valuable, whereas if you were a journalist and you wanted to find a source who would challenge what the Pentagon spokesperson, for instance, or the State Department spokesperson is saying, then you're liable to receive charges of bias, like you're trying to get your own view into the story by picking a source that you agree with. So that's one aspect of it. Then you have the ideology of the ownership of these outlets. You've got that, of course, can play out in the form of selecting editors who are ideologically congenial and who will enforce the agreed view in the coverage of that outlet. It can also find its way into the journalists who are hired to do the actual reporting. The editors might select journalists whose view on a particular issue matches theirs and matches the views of the ownership to cover particular stories versus other stories. And those are just a couple of the biases, the pressures that operate within the US media system that produce the kind of output we've seen, which, as you, I think, accurately summarized, is a kind of both sides-ing the genocide in Gaza. And then you've got other commercial pressures, like you don't want to cover a story in a way that's going to lose you some of your audience. You also want to avoid what Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky called FLAC, which is organized pressure groups, organizing perhaps boycotts for advertisers to media outlets in retaliation for the way that they cover an issue. So there's all these sorts of pressures. And just to drill down a little bit deeper into the ideological factor, like the ideology of owners of outlets, editors, journalists themselves, there's also a lot of just plain old-fashioned ignorance playing a role. So particular to the Israel-Palestine situation, if you were raised in a household that is very pro-Israeli government, it also means that the information that you're absorbing year after year after year after year tends to confirm your pro-Israeli government position. And you also tend to avoid information that would challenge your beliefs. And that sort of avoidance can happen in many different ways. One, simply avoiding journalists and outlets who give you a more pro-Palestine view. So I just dabbled a little bit into a collection of pressures that operate on the media system that in combination tend to produce the result that you're talking about.
So we have done a lot of shows on the media where, I mean, listeners can go and check it out. Like we dive into it much deeper on various episodes, including one where we talk about how media manufactures consent and all of that. But what does this mean for society, Peter? I mean, yes, things are changing. Younger people rely more on social media than corporate media. They're probably not even watching what's on CNN or Fox or MSNBC. They're on Twitter, they are on Instagram, and so on and so forth. But corporate media still has such a hold, not just on Americans, but on people around the world. They're so incredibly influential and powerful. We are right now witnessing a genocide live. And yet the media, the corporate media, the most influential media platforms in the world are essentially either being very half-truthy about this or just, you know, straight out taking the side of essentially the oppressors, right? Mm-hmm. What does this mean for society?
To the extent that these outlets are used widely by tens of millions, God forbid, maybe even hundreds of millions of people worldwide, well, it means that their worldview, their understanding of what's going on in the world is going to be powerfully shaped by the messages, the framing presented by these media outlets. At the same time, you know, you mentioned the difference in opinions between young and old people. I think you're referring to the U.S. there, but it right, might also yes. be prevalent in many parts of the world. I think that's a reflection of a very different media diet that younger generations are using compared to their older counterparts. And if that different media diet includes messages, framing, information, et cetera, that tends to be discarded or avoided by the mass media, legacy media outlets, well, then, you know, you're going to get exactly the result we see clearly in polling in the U.S. right now, where younger generations are far more critical of the Israeli government, more likely to want an immediate ceasefire than older generations. But overall, I mean, not just the young, recent polling has shown that a majority of people in the U.S. now want a ceasefire and think that there's been too much violence against Palestinians. So that, I think, is the cumulative result of many months of this story not only being covered in the mass media, where it tends to be both sides, or simply the framing is a Israeli government friendly framing, but then you also have, you know, the reality which trickles into some people's consciousnesses by social media. You know, that you can get just direct videos without any sort of framing by a media outlet. So I think that's what we're witnessing right now, this kind of clash between the worldview produced by having a corporate media heavy media diet versus the worldview and understanding produced by having more diverse sources of information, or simply using social media predominantly to get informed about the world.
On that note, millions of people, have been protesting all over the world, including in the US, which has seen hundreds of thousands of protesters march for Palestine in DC. It's the same in London, hundreds of thousands of people. We see protests all over the world, from Indonesia to Malaysia, everywhere, Yemen, the Middle East as a whole. So many countries, protests are going on in France, in Germany. What, and yet the political class, especially the US, don't seem to be budging. Yes, recently they, for once, didn't veto a UN resolution on this matter, but they're still sending billions of dollars worth of weapons to Israel. Now, we know why they do this. We've explored this on previous episodes where we talk about what the US and their Western imperial interests in Israel is. So we know that. But I think what's interesting and what's curious to me is that Biden's popularity, polling show, is dropping day by day. Everywhere he or Kamala Harris goes, people are suddenly interrupting them during speeches, protesting against them, demanding answers, asking them questions which they obviously just try to skirt around and don't really have an answer to. It's the same in the UK. In the Rochdale by-elections, George Galloway of the Workers' Party of Britain won both the Labour and the Conservative by a huge margin, specifically because he was campaigning on a pro-Palestinian platform and the rest are simply taking the side of Israel. But with all of that in context, you would think that this is what is required to stop a genocide. But the political class, especially in the US, is still standing quite firmly with Israel. Even Biden and all of that, despite the popularity dropping, because you would think that politicians are all more or less populists, unless you are very firmly, you believe in a particular ideology. Most part, you're populist. You do what's popular. You want to remain in power. If a particular issue is going to win you in elections or is gaining momentum in that sense, you just change your stance. Politicians change their stance overnight and so on and so forth. But this does not seem to be happening.
Well, you'll have to have somebody else on to explain why European politicians predominantly seem to be towing the U.S. line right on this. That was a surprise to me. And I'll need to listen to somebody else to explain that one to me better. But in the U.S., it's relatively simple, relatively easy to understand. For the Republican Party, the main base that supports the Israeli government, no matter what it does, is the evangelical Christian community. So the Republican Party's position on Israel is very understandable. Still, a majority of Republican voters are staunchly backing the Israeli government. In the Democratic Party, it's a little bit more interesting because a majority of Democratic voters is critical. A majority is critical of the Israeli government's policies. They want a ceasefire, et cetera. But you have to keep in mind the political economy in the U.S. where politicians don't necessarily look at public opinion polls to determine or to influence what they do. They have to be thinking about the major donors to their campaigns, because without a massive amount of money, they're simply not going to win, no matter what their policy positions are or how closely those positions match a majority of voters. So there you have within the Democratic Party a lot of, I guess you could call them NatSec liberals, like national security liberals, who simply go along with the predominant foreign policy thinking, which holds Israel to be a kind of, I think Biden put it, a land-based aircraft carrier in the region, basically a kind of a cat's paw, an asset that could be used to exert violence in the region for U.S. interests. So that's where the Democratic Party leadership is sticking. You could also mention ideological factors among the leadership of the party, which is all it's composed of very old people. Biden himself seems throughout his career to have a very close affinity to Zionist ideology, particularly, specifically in terms of supporting whatever the Israeli government wants to do. So you've got that factor as well, you know, the kind of gerontocratic old leadership of the Democratic Party with their ideology, which is shared by a lot of members of that generation, but of course, which conflicts with the view on this issue that is more widespread among the younger members of the Democratic coalition. So, I mean, there's a recent book by Vincent Bevins on protests and their seeming impotence over the past couple of decades. Also, how protest tactics have been widely adopted on the right in various countries around the world. And I think there's really a lot to that argument, whereby generations of people who are sort of on the left ideologically have been raised in an environment that tells them the way to do political action is protest. You go out on the street, you have signs, that gets media attention, that informs people about something they might not have known much about, and that is how political change happens. And I think, you know, especially over the past couple of decades, we can say that theory of political change is just not working. And I think that is a good reason to reconsider perhaps readopting some of the older forms of political organization, like a party, like a socialist party, which in all sorts of countries all over the world over the past couple of centuries have been quite effective at getting what they want done. You know, to varying extents. But I think the core difference is when you have an actual organization that can, you know, direct people to do particular things in concert, whether that be boycotting on the simplest end, all the way up to organizing strikes in various sectors that are directly related to war production and transportation. You know, these are things that you can't do just with a bunch of individuals expressing their views out in a protest. So I think that's really the thing that needs to change.
On the show with me today is Peter Beattie, political economist and political psychologist at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. We'll be back with more after the break. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashan Johan, and with me is Peter Beattie, political economist, political psychologist at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and we're talking about maintaining hope in dark times. This conversation is also available as a podcast. If you like conversations like these, look up Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. So, Peter, what has this reason, sort of past 6 months, what has it taught you about the role of international law and institutions such as the UN, International Criminal Court, International Court of Justice, all these various institutions, and how effective they are at holding powerful states accountable?
Well, one thing I learned over the past just month is that UN Security Council resolutions can sometimes be non-binding. I was entirely unaware of that. I'm being sarcastic. UN Security Council resolutions are all binding. It's just a matter of, in order to enforce them, you need the cooperation of the actual state members of the Security Council. And the U.S. is really the only one with the power to enforce it, and the U.S. government is refusing to do so. You know, theoretically, the rest of the state members of the Security Council could organize an armed humanitarian intervention on their own, but that would, of course, mean war with the U.S., and nobody, I don't think, is suicidal enough to want to do that. But rather than really learning much, the past 6 to 8 months have just kind of provided another example of how international law is fundamentally toothless. The UN and similar international organizations are toothless because they're simply composed of member states. The UN doesn't have any sort of significant separate power that it can exert. It's really just a sort of meeting ground for its member states. And if there's a recalcitrant kind of rogue state like the US with predominant power in the global system, then, you know, their usefulness is nil. And that's the problem with international law. Not that I'm someone who thinks that, you know, international law should just be discarded. Rather, I believe quite the opposite, that international law should govern state behavior. But in order for international law to actually govern state behavior, the most powerful states in the system would have to start adhering to international law, starting with, you know, just to pull one example, by implementing the ICJ decision, which has not happened. So it's really just, I mean, I guess for some people who had more, I don't know, hopeful ideas about international law and believed for some reason that it could be enforced kind of on its own or without the participation and acquiescence of the world's most powerful states, well, then I guess this was a good educational experience to let them know that, no, the problem with international organizations and international law is simply that you have no enforcement mechanism other than a powerful state enforcing both whatever the UN Security Council says and what international law says through courts like the ICJ.
Is it fair to look at it as, you know, the international law itself is actually really good? Like as a concept, it's very human rights centric. A lot of countries look up to international law to improve domestic policies. But the problem is now you have a few countries which are like superheroes in a world among mortals, right? And that among that you have Superman, which is the United States of America. And now you are saying, like, let's say you imagine Superman in our world right now. Imagine Superman's your neighbor. And now Superman kills your mom. What are you going to do? Literally, what are you going to do? Because you're going to call the cops. The cops can't cuff him. You put a handcuff on him, he can just break through the handcuffs. You put him in prison, he can break through prison. Superman can kill 1,000 people in 10 seconds if Superman wants to. Right? It's that kind of power. So how do you make sense of that? And what does that mean for the world? A country like Israel can seemingly commit massive crimes against humanity with complete impunity. The world can't actually do anything real yet, right? It hasn't translated to actually stopping the genocide or stopping the bombardment.
Well, I think your analogy is quite accurate. It's like there's that TV show in the U.S., The Boys,
yes,
which has like an evil version of Superman.
Homelander.
Yeah, that's I think a perfect analogy to explain international law. You're really up to the willingness to enforce international law, not by international policemen, but rather by the most powerful states in the system, kind of like evil Superman as the US. I mean, what does that mean for the world? I mean, it's really just a kind of continuation of the status quo ante. Like it's the continuation of the same basic structure of the international system that's existed for 10, 12,000 years ever since humans settled down and created sedentary civilizations, farming-based civilizations, and then had so many people that they could raise armies and engage in warfare to take other states' territories. Back then, you know, there was no international law. It's just basically might makes right. Now, you know, that same principle is still very much in effect. It's been somewhat fettered a little bit by norms, by international law. But as we've seen past 6 to 8 months, when those fetters become too annoying for the most powerful states in the system, they just cast them off and say, oh, UNSC resolutions are now non-binding. We just made up a new rule and this is what we're going with now. So I guess what we've been seeing, the import of these events for the world is that we're somewhat reverting back more to that guiding principle of might makes right, or Thucydides, the strong do as they will, the weak suffer as they must. And so it's hard to find a silver lining in that kind of grim conclusion. But I think if you want to find that silver lining, it would be in the form of people around the world waking up to, or rather kind of getting a bucket of ice water poured over their head and waking up to the reality that despite all of the talk of the rules-based order that U.S. politicians like to speak of, as if they're talking about international law, now I think it's readily apparent to people that the rules-based order U.S. politicians talk about really just means we, the U.S. government, make the rules, and that's it. They're not referring to international law. They're willing to trample over international law. This really shouldn't be news to people, at least our age and older. I mean, we just in our lifetimes, we've seen, you know, I guess when we were kids in the 80s, the first time that the U.S. just disregarded the ICJ in the Nicaragua case, then the U.S. war of aggression against Iraq. I mean, the U.S. support for the criminal Saudi-UAE war on Yemen, you know, all of these things should have alerted people to the fact that the rules-based order is really just the gangsters' rules rather than international law. But perhaps because there's been so much more public attention to the genocide in Gaza, the, you know, technological developments, meaning everyone has a camera on them at all times, so footage of atrocities can get out to people much more readily today. Perhaps it really is the case that right now, because of just this outburst of mass killing, people are going to wake up and realize that the rules-based order is not coterminous. It's not the same thing as international law. It's really just whatever rules the U.S. government wants to make.
So in moments like these, where it really feels like evil prevails, what can regular people do? What avenues of resistance and change remain available for regular people, for oppressed people? Maybe can expand on a couple of ideas you brought up earlier as well, where you talked about how protests have, you know, over the years, it's sort of become more like a theater that does not necessarily translate to big radical changes. And I think protests still can accomplish a lot, but if you look at these kind of big foreign policy issues, especially in big countries like the US, we look at even the Black Lives Matter protests, very important protests, thousands and thousands and thousands of people came onto the streets so passionately, demanding to defund the police and all of that. It did not translate into actual radical policy. The police is still the police in the US, right? So these protests don't seem to be working. You say it's more potent to start a new political party or, you know, go on strikes. Why?
Well, when I say political party, I mean like the party. Before they even would contest elections, the idea just being it's an organization. It's collecting people who have a similar view of the world, getting them in an organization where they receive directions, they receive orders. So even a relatively small number of people can exert disproportionate impact because they're all working together to achieve the same goals. And of course, some of those goals include proselytization, like convincing other people, educating other people why they're in this organization and why they, the outsiders, should join. So I think that's the nature. And then, of course, you know, to bring it back to the issue of the genocide in Gaza, you know, what would such an organization attempt to do? How would it attempt to leverage the latent power of its members? Well, it would vary country by country. If it means a trade embargo with Israel, some sort of maybe even targeted trade embargo against the U.S. Or refusing to follow the U.S.'s orders or instructions regarding China, whatever it is, whatever the leverage points are, using the members of that organization to put pressure on the government to actually use that leverage in the way that they want. In the US, it would be a very different, more direct form of action. You know, pressuring the government to immediately cutting off arms sales. That could be trying to foment strikes or refuse for strikes at arms manufacturers themselves, or refusal by transport workers of all sorts to transport weaponry. So this is the basic sort of thinking of having the party or organization, regardless of whether it's running candidates or trying to win a majority in the parliament or the Congress or whatever it is. Leaving that aside, just looking at the basic goal of amassing as many people as possible into an organization that's actually organized and gets its members to collectively work to achieve various sorts of political economic change.
You also mentioned strikes. Why are strikes more potent than protests?
A strike is actually directly affecting production. So if you have a strike in a Raytheon factory in the US that produces missiles that are then sent to the IDF, that actually stops the production of those missiles. It's a real world immediate impact versus this kind of hopeful, maybe one day if we do enough protests, we'll change enough minds. Or the other kind of protest goal or the thinking that motivates protests is that it will put the fear of God in elected officials who will worry that a large protest means that they might lose the next election. But I just don't see evidence for that sort of effectiveness on the using a protest strategy recently, as in past several decades. Perhaps you would just need a protest so massive, but that's another benefit of a strike versus a protest, because a strike only needs the number of workers in a given enterprise or factory whose labor is absolutely essential to keep that factory going. It would vary factory to factory. It could be 10%, 15%, 20%, 30%, and then you basically can't operate according to, up to anywhere near capacity. You might even need to shut down if you're missing key labor inputs to that process. So just the effectiveness is greater, and the percentage of people you would need in the organization, the total number of people you would need participating is lower as well.
You know, when I go on Twitter, for example, I see some people saying like the solution to what we are seeing right now is to start a revolution, to completely boycott the US and etc. I think the idea is great. I think the idea is something that we need to have in our back of our minds. You need to think about that, right? But the reality on the ground is that in most parts of the world, whether we look at Malaysia or whether we look at US, the UK, class consciousness is incredibly low. Politics centered around the culture wars. You know, even when we look at this idea of boycotting the US, I think when you perhaps, I'm imagining that most leaders, political leaders in the global South secretly may want to boycott the US. But the reality is they will say, you know, look at China, even China, and that is China. It's very self-reliant, huge country, huge economy. They still rely on FDI from the US. You know, they do a lot of trade with the US. And so is it realistic for smaller countries to, quote unquote, boycott the US? These are all real questions being asked. So how do you make sense of that? What would it take to build a world where countries like Israel and the US do not have impunities to do what they want? A world where everybody is mortal to some degree, or you know, where there's no Superman who can just do whatever they want at any time, and nobody has the real capacity, the real power to stop this person or this entity. How do you make sense of all of this?
I think I would look, instead of the Superman analogy, I would think of the Lilliputians from Gulliver's Travels. One individual tiny little Lilliputian couldn't do anything to tie down a giant. But when you have hundreds or thousands of Lilliputians working together to tie down a giant, that can very well work. I think your example of China is a really good one. You know, I was just talking with a friend recently. The conversation was about, you know, why hasn't Iran attempted to, you know, do more to stop this genocide? And I was just pointing out, you know, that would essentially, depending on what actions you're talking about, mean war with the U.S.
Right.
And war with the U.S. would mean just an utter destruction, mass murder in Iran. So it's understandable why the Iranian government would be very worried about escalating any sort of violence with the U.S. and Israel that could result in a full bombardment campaign. Well, that goes as well for even China, which is certainly the most powerful state in the system other than the U.S., but there's a significant drop-off between one and two. So even China would be worried about, okay, if we do anything really significant to attempt to end this genocide, like a humanitarian intervention, well, then that would give the U.S. the excuse lots of members of the foreign policy establishment in the U.S. want anyway, which is to wage war on China, which would also lead to massive loss of life, devastation, et cetera. So I think the only solution to that is unity. There has to be a much greater unity among the world's majority countries, call it global South if you want. But without that unity, then each individual country can be picked off. And it, of course, doesn't need to be in the form of overt military violence. It can simply be in the form of economic pressure. You're reliant on this input that we make, but you can't make because you don't have the requisite technology and know-how. And by cutting you off from this, it's going to wreak devastation throughout your economy. Even that sort of a threat can be enough to prevent any small country from doing anything that the mafia don doesn't want them to do. But when you have cooperation and organization among a lot of countries, then you can have a significant counterweight politically. So I think that's the goal. And you can look to the apartheid struggle in South Africa. I mean, that lasted decades, but it eventually was successful. You had so many organizations around the world, countries as well, joining in boycotts, putting economic pressure on the South African government. And also there was this broad sense of cultural pressure, especially in Europe, where, you know, the South African white ruling class actually, you know, looked up to Europe and they really cared what those people thought. So being viewed as anathema, being viewed as racist criminals by people that they looked up to was very hard for them. And I think that was another, in addition to the economic pressure, another thing that forced them to get rid of their apartheid policy. There needs to be a common cause, common action among lots of countries, which individually couldn't do anything against the empire, but united in a kind of united front, then they can actually exert some serious influence.
Let's go for another quick break. On the show with me today is Peter Beattie, political economist and political psychologist at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. We will be back with more after these messages. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashan Johan, and on the show with me today is Peter Beattie, political economist and political psychologist at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and we're talking about maintaining hope and optimism in dark times. So one of the reasons I wanted to do this topic with you, do this episode with you, Peter, is because I think a lot of what is going on in the world, it tends to lead a lot of people to this feeling of doomerism. Life is unfair. You can't do anything about these problems. Nothing will change. So you just focus on yourself. What would you say to people who are giving these types of, or who are feeling this way right now?
You know, they're feeling that way for a good reason.
Absolutely.
To me, it kind of sounds like the psychological opposite of system justification tendency, where the realization that things are so unjust in the world pushes people to deny that and just try to believe that actually everything is fine, everything is just. This seems to be the kind of opposite of that, like providing the same sort of mental medicine, I guess, in the face of an unjust world. But instead of trying to gussy it up as actually it's fine, people acknowledge that, but then are pushed into isolation and just individualism. I would just say that, you know, as difficult as it seems emotionally, working together, joining organizations, attempting to recruit new members to these organizations, that kind of work, you know, it's you might not see the end goals that you desire come to fruition immediately, but I think that can provide the same kind of psychological support, the same kind of psychological medicine, because the actions that you take in attempting to build a political organization are the sorts of things that kind of distract your mind away from the horrors of current reality. Not that you're saying that they don't exist or you're ignoring them, but rather because you know that they exist and because they are viewed correctly by you as such a horrible thing to change, that can propel you or provide fuel, motivation, energy, et cetera, in your efforts as just one little person, one little ant in a colony, doing one tiny little thing as part of a greater whole. I think that can provide the same sort of psychological succor, and probably more effectively than simply resigning oneself to how horrible the world is and focusing on one's own personal concerns, because that realization of how terrible the world is not going to go away that way.
Does the arc of history bend towards justice?
I tend to think so, but you know, if you look at the broad scope of human history, Homo sapiens history, it kind of starts off in a more just direction when we're small hunter-gatherer tribes that are aggressive egalitarians. And then it turns the exact opposite direction once the emergence of sedentary civilizations occurs. And I think since then, you can kind of trace a kind of arc of history bending towards justice. But of course, it's a pretty slow process. Looked at from the perspective of, you know, mortal people like we are that tend to think in terms of our lifetime or maybe even just the next 10 years or the prime of our lives when we want to see all of the positive changes in the world occur. But yeah, I would say that it seems like at least if we start the clock from 10,000 years ago, we can discern a noticeable, if mild, bend in that arc towards justice.
There is also this risk, right? Because I too think that the arc of history bends towards justice, but I think there's an important component there, right? This idea that the arc of history bends towards justice is everybody comes together and do the bending. I think that's an important thing, right? Because there is a tendency for some people to look at whatever that's going on in the world and just be like, yeah, but look at how far we've come. So, you know, things will change. And I think that could lead towards complacency.
Yeah, I would just reiterate your point that it requires millions of people jumping onto that arc and trying to pull it to bend towards justice a lot faster. But I don't worry so much, I guess, about that mindset. And the reason why I don't is I was thinking of like the socialist movements a century ago from a psychological perspective. Like, you know, from within Marxist thinking, the idea is, you know, history is an evolutionary process. We can discern a direction in that evolutionary process. And so the evolution of the current political economy, from capitalism to socialism is essentially guaranteed. Like, that's just how the evolutionary process is going to work. And you might think about that view of the world, that that would lead to complacency, because people could just say, well, why do I need to do anything? Why do I need to join the labor union? Why do I need to join the party? I'll just, you know, focus on my life and just let the evolutionary process work on its own, and it'll eventually move towards socialism. So, you know, but that's not what we saw. You had tens of millions of people around the world willing to sacrifice it all to work towards that goal, even if they believed, according to their understanding of Marxist theory, that this process was inevitable anyway.
So before we end this conversation, how are you looking at this whole situation? You know, what we've been witnessing over the past 5 to 6 months, and what do you think? How are you holding on to optimism? And why do you think, or do you think it's important for people to have that sense of optimism, to keep pushing, to keep struggling for change, to come together? Perhaps a message of hope from you.
It's essential to have optimism of the will, to act as if you're optimistic, regardless of what, you know, what ideas are bouncing around inside your skull, right? So optimism of the will, first of all. Second of all, I guess the optimistic aspect of, I can't believe the sentence is coming out of my mouth, the optimistic aspect of this genocide is that when you look at public opinion, I mean, I focus on the U.S., but it's not limited to the U.S. All over the world, you can see this. That there's so much public opposition to the Israeli government's perpetrating genocide in Gaza. And you might say, okay, well, that's to be expected. But just go back a few years when the U.S., UAE, Saudi, U.K. coalition was murdering an estimated over 300,000 people in Yemen. There was not that much just knowledge about that atrocity, period. Like, right. Forget about opposition. There was just very little knowledge or awareness. Contrast that to the mass murder going on in Palestine and how much public opposition there is to that. This demonstrates that people do care about, you know, war and mass murder around the world. And if they find out about it, if they actually are educated about it, if they can connect emotionally with the victims, which for that to happen, you actually need to see them. You need to know about them. You have to understand them as humans, as people. That is now happening in this instance of mass murder, whereas we could look not too far back in the recent past to find other examples of mass murder that people just didn't know anything about and didn't react to as a result of being ignorant. So I guess that's the hopeful aspect of this atrocity.
Peter, as always, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Dashran. Until next time.
That was Peter Beattie, political economist and political psychologist at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.